Garrett Edelstein here, your celeb expert and your celeb savant. Celeb Savant is a weekly entertainment show. We have long-form career retrospective type interviews with celebrities, singers, actors, and industry experts. If you know South African music, you definitely know the songs Indigo Girl and Letters. With the very early success of these smash hit singles and two South African Music Award winning albums under their belt, the band has maintained and grown a loyal following both locally and internationally for 22 years. Subsequently, all their albums have achieved gold or platinum status on various sales platforms. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Craig Hines from Watershed. Craig, how are you? Where do we find you in the world and what's happening in your life?
How's it, Bird? I'm currently in Cape Town. We recently got back from a tour with a band to Europe. We did Germany and Austria, and we got back a couple of weeks ago. And I think just settling into South Africa again, planning our season of shows heading into summer when we get pretty busy. But it's sort of more a little bit of admin now, along with shows popping in and out here and there.
The difference between audiences in Europe and South Africa, are there differences?
I would say, absolutely. I think, South African audiences are sort of, I would think, are on different levels, are more reserved. But at some, and on other levels, the European audiences are more reserved. And I think what I mean by that is that during showtime, so when the band is on stage, the European audiences seem to be more reserved, so quieter. They sort of really, it seems like they're there to watch, and sort of just sort of take it all in. The South African audiences during the shows tend to be slightly more rowdy, sort of jumping up and down and getting involved. But then afterwards, the Europeans like to come up and chat and sort of engage at that level. And in South Africa, it seems at that point, South Africans are more shy.
That's interesting you say that. The thing is that, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, is that in Europe and America, artists are a dime a dozen in the sense they're there so often and so regularly. So there's a perception of that the artist is one of the crowd. Whereas in South Africa, because we have less, and it's happening more regularly now, we're more artists for the last 20 years or so since, end of apartheid, 25 years, that we have more artists coming through. We feel that, the artist is over there, a distance away from us, and they a little bit more reserved in the sense, or shy to speak to them in the sense that, are we allowed to do it? Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think we've been sort of fame has really catapulted sort of globally because of social media, and I think everyone wants to be famous because they think everyone can be famous. It's sort of something that everyone aspires to. I think back in the day, people just got on with life and they worked, and you had your normal jobs that were sort of floating about, but now most people see, celebrity is littered all over social media, and I think a lot of people want to be that. I think fame is sort of really put up there now to be famous. And I'm not saying that Watershed on any sort of level as some of these worldwide superstars, whether they be famous for some dance on TikTok, or famous for a big hit song, or a sporting legend. I think it seems so accessible that the people sort of tend to think it's really easy, and at that point to be famous is something really special. So everyone is really sort of supporting. They're loving the whole idea of it.
Exactly. So now let's take it all the way back to the beginning of the band. Tell us the journey of Watershed. First of all, tell us, where does the name come from? And why that name?
So right in the beginning, I'm talking now, 1999, so 23 years back, when I first started the band with another guy. And the idea was to call it Watershed. I thought of the name because I actually came from a teaching background. I actually studied school teaching and qualified as a school teacher, and then went on to teach for 2 years. So I think that complete change of scenery, from being a school teacher to choosing a career in music was a pretty sort of substantial, watershed for me, at that time of my life to take the risk to get involved in original music. You know, I think it's one thing to play cover, to be a part of a cover band in pubs, where you can earn sort of fairly decent money, whether, you know, as long as you play good cover songs. But I think to take the plunge and decide on an original music career, as I say, coming from something quite stable, you know, a day job, it was, as I say, quite a sort of watershed moment. Right. And yeah, it all kicked off in 2000, which was the release of Watershed's first album in the meantime.
Tell us about the creative process of creating music. Is it the same every time? Is it different? Is it collaborative? What is that process for yourself?
Yes, it's, you know, I think making music at this level for 22 years now is something that is really cool. And I think one never gets tired of it. Because I think music, for me as a writer, always evolves. I think the way I listen to music is not necessarily your sort of just putting a radio on or putting your favorite Spotify playlist on and listening to music. That's sort of more when you're completely relaxing, you're at a party or whatever, then you just sort of tend to sit and enjoy music, I think. But 9 times out of 10, I mean, I battle to even walk through a shopping center when they're playing music through the system in particular shops, because I lose concentration because I'm really sitting and listening to that actual song and what's going down in that song and why they're doing that. And so I think it's permanently listening, sort of really scrutinizing songs and really listening to what's going on out there, what artists are doing. You know, and I think all of that sort of information that you take on board definitely plays a part in where you are creatively as an artist, or at least it helps tweak where you think you might be heading. I feel that over the 20 years, my songwriting style has sort of remained true to the music that I think I write naturally. You know, I've never felt, you know, I've never wanted any song to sort of sound contrived, you know, as if you've sort of try too hard to make it something. I think the song needs to be completely natural to you, so that people get to, I think they naturally then just pick up that this sounds real. And at that point, I believe people will get behind that music and that artist.
I'm not sure if you're aware about NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. For those people who don't know, I'm also an NLP coach, and people absorb information differently, kinesthetically, audio, visually. So when you hear music, what do you hear? Do you hear the energy? Do you hear the instrumentation? Do you hear the voices or the words clearly? What's the first, when you hear a song, what's the first element you hear in your world?
I think the thing that pulls me in initially is the groove. So it's the energy and the groove of that particular song. And I think once that's got my attention, I'll then probably start picking up on hook lyrics. And then only once those hooks are, I've sort of picked up on those, I'll probably start listening to the lyrics and the story. But I think up front, you're drawn to a song by just hearing that instant energy. And it is because I think a lot of my songwriting is very lyric focused, but I'm not one of those writers where you've written sort of, if for want of a better word, you've written a poem, mm-hmm. and then having to go and find music to make that poem a song. Mm-hmm. I also write that way. I'll first try and find something that I think could be a good sort of groove, whether it be for an up-tempo or for a more of a ballad. And I think once that's established and there's a hook there, I'll naturally then start with the lyrics as sort of the second tier of that creative process.
And is that process easy for you always, or is it sometimes a bit of a challenge?
Yeah, you know, I mentioned the word contrived a couple of minutes ago, and I think I'm one of those that I'm a firm believer in it being completely natural to you. You know, everything you do, the way you do things, the way you play your guitar, the way you write songs, the way you write words, it needs to feel natural. And I think one thing I've always told myself is, if I haven't got a good idea of where the song's going regarding melody and regarding a lyrical idea, after 20 minutes, 30 minutes, I'll probably put the song aside.
Okay.
Because all I think is what starts to happen then is you start to think too hard mm-hmm. about the idea. And I think at that point for me, and all writers are different. Some guys can sit and they work for a long time to really make that story just perfect. For me, I want the story to make sense really quickly. So once again, I think it goes down to that point where, you know, if the song's feeling good, it should happen pretty quickly. If you start trying too hard, I think the public will pick up on that and go like, trying a little bit too hard.
Yeah. Now the song Indigo Girl is, tell me a little bit more about that.
It was, you know, really simple song. I remember writing it. I was still living with my folks, and there was a piano at home, and I was messing around with that piano and came up with a piano line first. It was my right hand, and I was playing that line over and over again, and then I managed to add the bass line, which really made it then sound really cool. And I just kept on playing that over and over again because I love that riff. And then I started to hum that over that thing. And that worked really well as a sort of a counter sort of melody to what the piano was doing. And then the words Indigo Girl I started to sing those words over and over again. And once that was established, so the piano hook was done, the melody was done, and there was a strong lyric that was mm-hmm. something that I could then write the rest of the song around. Then it happened, and the song happened really quickly as well. And for me, it was then done. It was just another song. And if I take you right up to that first album, so that obviously happened probably 2 years before two or 3 years before the release of the first album in 2000. And when we got to record that album, Indigo Girl was never even going to be a single. I think we put it at track 9 on the album. So it wasn't considered to be a single. And just strange things happened. And the song just did incredible things.
So now, why the color indigo? Was there any specific reason around that? Because the reason I asked is, do you know about indigo children?
Yes. No, I've been asked this question many, many times. And I think, I first heard about Indigo Children quite a long time after I'd written the song.
Okay.
So to answer your question, it isn't about Indigo Children. An Indigo person for me is the perfect person. So you're singing about that perfect person that would you long for to be in your life. you know, and I think there's a whole mix of various things that you know, the color indigo has become that color for that particular song. The word indigo and the way it's sung fitted in really well with the melody. So there's a bit of a combination of various things, and because of the one thing, another element has been brought out in the color indigo.
It's interesting because whenever I used to hear that song, because I'd known about that and all this stuff, I'm like, this is about indigo children. This is about indigo children. So those guys who are listening who don't know about indigo children, Google it. Giving you some homework.
Yes.
Now tell us more about the new album and the new songs.
So just to quickly rush through the career, in 2004, 2003, we released our second album called Wrapped in Stone. And then we did an album in 2005 called Mosaic, and we had some nice tunes on that album. You know, I think every album for me has had a very special place. It's normally a body of work that's sort of in the same theme, production-wise, going the same route, and all the while, I think, trying to just improve and progress. And so the 2000s, we released four albums. Mm-hmm. And, they just all had really cool things about them. Some were easier to record. It sort of happened easier. Some took a little bit longer. I was doing a little bit of co-writing in the UK, and I think I did some work in Nashville around that time as well. But definitely those four albums fit into that decade. Moving into the 2010s to now, we've released three albums during that time, 2015, 2018, and 2021. With Elephant in the Room being our latest album. But for me, these three albums are substantially different to the four albums in the 2000s. Keeping in mind the songwriter sort of remained the same, but from a production point of view, we've really wanted to sort of just tweak a few things. And I think the three albums, from Watch the Rain in 2015 to Harbor in 2018 to Elephant in the Room now, I just feel that each album has progressed and just for us sounded better and better. So it feels that we're on the right track. And very, very happy with Elephant, which was released last year.
There was a bit of a gap between the 2015 and the 2000s. What were you doing in that gap period? Were you still writing and touring, or did you take a break? What was happening in your world?
Well, I think according to the public, we took a break or a hiatus, as it's often been called, but we actually didn't. We kept touring, so we've never stopped touring, even during that 2008 to 2015. In 2010, we released a best of called A Million Faces, which had a few singles on there as bonus track. But the album was 20 hits in 10 years. And we took the 20 songs we had had on radio for years, and those were the songs that we put on the album. We actually had an awesome campaign. We got all the Watershed fans to send in a tiny little pixelated shot of themselves, and mm-hmm. or at least a photograph. And we then pixelated this whole thing into thousands of fans' faces, which made up the album cover.
Oh, I remember that actually. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So we put that out in 2010. And then it was World Cup, I think, and so everything went a bit ballistic. I think we had a song that was featured on some World Cup thing, which was quite fun. And then in 2012, I did a solo album called Ordinary Boy, which I went and recorded in LA with a friend of mine over there. And that had nothing to do with Watershed stopping to play. It was purely a time I went away, wrote songs, recorded, released, and, you know, life went on for Watershed, but I also had this sideline project on. Unfortunately, and I say that because I really enjoyed the Ordinary Boy album, and I think it needed a little bit more love and attention. I think it could have done more stuff. But I think around about then it was 2013, 2014, and the vibe was that we needed another Watershed album. So Ordinary Boy seemed to take a back seat. But that's cool. I really enjoy the album. And then came 2015 and another Watershed album mm-hmm. popped along. So that's sort of the last 22 years for you.
And Ordinary Boy, it is available for people to listen to or purchase or download.
Yes, okay. Absolutely. So that is on, you'll search Craig Hines.
Yeah.
And then there is only one album. There.
Yes. So we'll, listeners, we'll give it more love. Let's get it back out there.
Give it a little bit more love.
Definitely. I'll be listening to that and downloading that. So now, when you first started recording, releasing, it was more CDs at that time than cassettes, more CDs. Gratefully for me and a bunch of people, I'm very happy about it. CDs and vinyls and cassettes are making a comeback. But it's now these digital platforms. Your thoughts around the way consumers are now listening to music on those platforms. What are your thoughts around it?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's. I think the big upside is that your music is consumed worldwide or can be consumed worldwide. So we're getting exposure in a lot more territories than we used to back in the Indigo Girls days. It was really up to your record label. You would be released physically in South Africa. If another country picked up on your music, you'd be released physically there. It would really have to be a massive deal for your CDs to be distributed worldwide. So the big upside is that, you know, your music's way more accessible. The downside is that, which I think is quite obvious, is that streaming platforms, you're not earning nearly as much as you were earning through a CD sale or a vinyl sale, that sort of thing. So people are also consuming music way quicker because it's so digital, it's so quick, it's like 30 seconds, and if they don't dig the song, they're going to move on to the next one. Whereas back in the day, you'd buy a CD and that was yours. You're sort of almost forced to listen to the whole thing because you've just paid $130 for it. So it's a catch 22, and I think it's pointless sort of harping on the good old days, because things move at an incredibly fast pace nowadays. And being able to find a song, Shazam a song, make playlists, go on, listen to something, it's really easy, and I think that's made life cool. It's a tough one, but people are listening quickly, people are wanting results, and as an artist, I think it's cool, because for us to listen to what's happening anywhere in the world, what's on radio, what are people streaming, what's popular, what's happening on TikTok, what's going on, for us, we can pick up on that and see what trends are doing. And that was always very different back then. I think with digital, with technology, suddenly there are thousands and thousands and thousands more bands in the world, because it's very easy for someone to set up a home studio and record an album and record a song. And so it's just, there's just so much music nowadays. So because of that, it can only be a good thing. It's cool.
But I hear what you're saying, but for me, I have my Spotify, but I still love my CDs. I love holding that thing, that aesthetic thing, looking at the booklets and experiencing it, because, and just unpacking a couple of the elements you just spoke of. First of all, with regards to having the Spotify, like, for example, I create playlists for certain things, and I'll go back 6 months down the line or a year down the line, I go back into that specific playlist and some of the songs have been removed. Are they now no longer on the platform? And it was like, well, why aren't they there? Whereas if I've got the CD and if I've got the physical thing, it's always there, it's always tangible, it's always mine. But what you said about the quickness and the fastness of it, do maybe not think that people are not taking the time to absorb the music energetically anymore, because it's so fast paced, it's sort of going over them and past them instead of them experiencing it?
100%. Yeah. I mean, it's as you say, that aesthetic thing, that physical thing with the band's photographs on them, and you get to know each band member because they've each written a little thank you and a little thing about their family and a little thing about their history. And their photographs in that thing, and all the words are there, and you can read the words over and over again. I know on Spotify and those channels, you can go, and the lyrics are there, but it's more like a karaoke. You're singing along, and the words. It's that thing that, I mean, I'm the same as you. Don't get me wrong. I'm a big fan in physical. The new album, we've actually done it in vinyl as well, so it's available in vinyl. And I tell you, when we received those vinyls, it was a really special moment, because that's our eighth album, and it's also, sorry, seventh album. And it's the first time we've had vinyl, and that's in 2021, you know? And so it seems a bit odd that we didn't have vinyl in 2000, but we've got it now. But I think that's just a group of people that are saying, wow, it is so cool to actually have these things.
If you look at the physical elements at the moment, vinyl is the top, as in making comeback. CDs last year, the first time in 21 years, numbers had an increase in sales. And cassettes, can you believe cassettes are also making a comeback? So,
really?
Yeah, absolutely. And they, I follow the official charts, which is the UK. You know, they have the UK charts and the Billboard charts. And on the UK charts, they keep going on about how much percentage of sales have increased for vinyl, CDs, and cassettes each year. And the numbers aren't like 1% or 2%. It's like 20, 30, 40% that the numbers increasing. So that's fantastic.
Yeah, it is cool. And what was so cool about physical from an artist perspective is that you knew if you sold a vinyl or you sold a CD, you knew exactly how much money was going to come into your bank account, because you had done a deal with the label. That was the sum. This is what you're getting. Nowadays, if someone listens to a song for 30 seconds, there's a different algorithm to what you're going to earn if they listen to the entire song.
I didn't know that. That's interesting. So if a person listens to the whole song, you might get a little bit more than if they listen to half the song.
Full stream. Yeah, there's a difference if it's full streams.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting. But still, even if it's a full stream, it's not amazing money either. I mean, it's like 0.1 cent or something ridiculous.
It's incomparable.
Tell me about your enjoyment of performing live. What is that experience for you? Besides the differences for audiences, getting out there, performing your songs live, what do you enjoy about it? And has the experience changed over the last 20 years?
I think the older I've got, the more I've enjoyed it. But that's because I think, you know, when I was younger, it was more a chaos. Like my memories of those early days of shows are a little bit vague. And it's just because maybe it was nerves, maybe our interpretation of the songs on stage as opposed to the album. You know, are you thinking you must stick exactly to what the album sounds like live, or how? And I think trying to often play that album live and play it exactly the same way. I know my vocals, for one thing, as far as I'm concerned, have improved over the 20 years. So I'm way more comfortable to get on stage now and actually sing well. Whereas 20 years back, I was always really nervous to sing because I was quite a late developer in music. And so I always felt a little bit uncomfortable and sort of often wondered why I'd sung that way on the album. And now I've got to suddenly try and repeat it like that. Whereas now I know that if I go into studio and sing, I will be singing it the same way live because my singing is sort of better. So you sort of, from that perspective, I'm a lot more confident on stage now, and it's purely because I think my singing has improved. But that's just years and years and years of practice. And also you sort of become more confident with yourself and with your band. you know, so to not be scared to extend the song, play it for 7-8 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, give people a live experience.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to listen to the album, there's the album.
Mm-hmm.
This is the live show. There are obviously elements from the album that you want, you people have come to hear. They've come to hear certain choruses and hooks and melody and lyrics. They want to hear those. But if you shift it here and there, or break it down a little bit more acoustic here, or make it bigger there, I think that's really cool, and that makes live great. So I think our live performance over 20 years has subtly improved annually.
Brilliant. So I'm going to put you on the spot. I love playing this game. Some people freak out by it, but others get to the answer easily. Your, when I say favorite, is favorite inverted commas. Your five top songs by other artists.
It'll be Stereophonics, Dakota.
Yep.
It'll be Don Henley, Boys of Summer.
Okay.
It'll be The Counting Crows, probably a song like, I don't know, maybe Anna Begins. Then it would be Fleetwood Mac. What song of theirs? I mean, all of their songs were so good. Quacky. It is actually a tough question because you don't actually really think about it. Oh, I need to be asking a friend.
Phone a friend.
I need to phone a friend.
So for Fleetwood Mac, which one would you say?
I mean, even older than them, like Supertramp, like Dreamer, or one of those songs.
Okay. So then we've got one more.
Yeah, I would go.
We'll keep it with the Fleetwood Mac entire catalog. So you've got
yes,
four.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. There we go.
I think that's a safe one.
The podcast is listened to locally and around the world. So as a final message to our listening audience, what would you like to say?
Well, first of all, thanks for listening. Really amazing to be on your chat. Yeah, I mean, we carry on. We love what we do. We love that we've got a really, really nice, loyal fan base worldwide. And yeah, we're going to carry on with what we're doing, trying to make good music, trying to make good albums. And yeah, I suppose just try and enjoy life for what it is and enjoy, yeah, enjoy music for the life it brings us.
Amazing. So this is Slevsvant signing out with Craig Hines. Thank you so much, Craig.
Thank you very much.